This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. After a whirlwind reunion with a childhood sweetheart, Addie Lockwood found herself unexpectedly pregnant. She decided to give her child up for adoption. It was not an easy choice, and even before the child was born, Addie began writing letters to him. That's the premise of Bird, a new novel by Raleigh-based author Kim Church. It was composed of letters and vignettes about choice and consequence, and Kim Church joins us now on The State of Things. Welcome, Kim. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
In the beginning of the book, Addie is in fourth grade. We really follow her through her life, right?
Yes, you get 45 years in under 250 pages. You get your money's worth with this book.
tell us about this is quite an arc that you created. Was this your intention at the beginning, or did you find yourself having to go back and give us more of her story?
You know, at the beginning, I only imagined the situation that she was in. I did not have everything outlined. I didn't know how far back in time I would need to go or how far forward I would need to carry this story. I basically let the story tell itself to me as I worked.
We meet a character named Roland in his childhood. Tell us about their relationship.
Roland is the new boy in fourth grade. This is in a small fictional North Carolina town, Carswell. Roland has moved with his family from Birmingham, Alabama. He is, Addie has a crush on him from the time she first sees him. He's exotic. He's from elsewhere. He's attractive. He gets a lot of attention as the new boy. And so he sort of takes her out of herself a little bit. He doesn't notice her at all.
Will you read for us?
Of course. This is from a chapter called Queen of Mind Beauty, and this is early in the book. The new boy's long legs jut into the aisle. His hair is shiny and dark as Coca-Cola. Addie once gave a boy her ice cream dime to let her touch his hair. It was short and flat on top, a brush cut, which she imagined would be stiff like the bristles of a toothbrush. But it was soft, like her father's softest shoe brush. The new boy writes left-handed, and when Miss Overcash calls him to the board for his times tables, he stands close, his elbow over his head and his face almost against the board so that no one can see his wrong answers until he's finished. He gets chalk dust on his shirt from standing so close. Miss Overcash has to brush him off. It's embarrassing to watch, but thrilling, too, like watching someone get punished. He stands very still and stares out the window as if he's somewhere else, as if that isn't chalk dust flying off his shirt. In the cafeteria, he bites his ice cream sandwich into a different animal shape every day. People call out, giraffe, elephant, bear. Addie calls out, but he never makes hers. Once he was making a rabbit, so she said, rabbit, but then he changed it into something else. She thinks his name sounds like a place, Roland Rhodes, a faraway place. One that would take a long time to get to, and once you did, you would never want to come back.
Kim Church reading from her debut novel, Bird. So she is clearly taken by him, as you said.
Yes.
They reconnect. Yeah. Things don't really come together as you would hope they might, given her crush on him then. But they do reconnect in their 30s. Tell us about that.
They do, and I'll back up just a bit. They actually do become friends in high school. Roland discovers Addie as a poet, and he's a musician, and so they do form a friendship in high school. So they do have a friendship to sort of come back to in their 30s. Addie has been living a fairly solitary life as a bookstore clerk in Greensboro, North Carolina. She has just ended an affair and decides to call Roland out of the blue. She's heard that he's living in Los Angeles and calls him up, and he invites her out for a visit. And this is the reunion that results in her unplanned pregnancy.
The germ for this this story actually came to you, I understand, during a conversation at a dinner party.
That's right, and a conversation that took place a long time before I was even writing fiction. I was fascinated. Announced at dinner that his ex-girlfriend at the time had given up their child for adoption. And he didn't seem particularly emotional about it or curious about it. And of course, I didn't press him, and I didn't know his ex-girlfriend. But my thoughts just flew to this woman and how this would not be casual dinner conversation for her. You know, I wondered if she'd told anyone what had happened, you know, and how she'd come to make the choice and how she was living with the knowledge that she had carried this child to term, given birth, and she had a child in the world who was a stranger. So I was really haunted by this character. And when I began to write fiction, I knew that I wanted to write about her, but I didn't. I knew she needed more than the space of a short story. And when I first started writing, I was writing stories. So when I got brave enough or crazy enough to try a novel, I decided it was time to tell her story.
And you did so. You searched for other novels like it, right?
I did. What I tend to do always when I want to, when I'm curious about something, is I look for something to read. And I tend to look for fiction. And there's a lot of literature about mothers or women who are victimized by their circumstances somehow, women who have given up children for adoption, but usually as underage, unwed mothers. And the characters I read in fiction, these are really interesting, compelling stories, but they were not really making the choice, most of them. They, you know, their parents were making the decisions for them. I was really interested in the whole topic of choice. You know, how do you make a choice like this, and then how do you live with this choice? And I found nothing like this in literature, and so...
And you talked about the interval between that dinner party when you weren't really writing fiction at all and then coming back to the story. Had that conversation kind of been with you this whole time? Had you always thought this needs to be a story?
It had. And I think I had sort of tried hard to imagine this woman over the years. I was really, I mean, it was like having a grown-up imaginary friend almost. And I think that's, you know, I think that's, for me anyway, that tends to be what things I write about are things that I become strangely obsessed with. And I was obsessed with this situation and, you know, how this woman was handling it. And of course, this book is purely fiction. I know nothing about the real life person who inspired it. But I was curious to understand her situation.
Well, it's interesting to me because we're in the humanities now, and a moment ago we were talking about the sciences, but if you think about the connection, when you have this question that you don't know the answer to, but that you're very curious about, you know, how do you explore? How do you find answers? And in the humanities and these kind of questions about the human condition, you know, one thing is to read, but then the other is to actually create, to make it up.
Right, to use your imagination. Although I will tell you that I started writing the book based on imagination, and I backed away from it initially because I began to worry that I didn't have the authority to tell this story because it was not my experience. And, you know, it's a very loaded topic, and I worried that there would be something I was missing. And for better or worse, I'd told a number of friends that I was working on a book about this subject matter and was introduced to several birth parents who were willing to be interviewed about their experiences. That was really helpful to me. That was my scientific research. Although what it really did for me was give me permission to imagine Addie, because what these parents told me was so different. Each of them had such a different story to tell. And I realized after talking with them that there is no one reaction to this experience.
Well, it's interesting with this topic, the multiplicity of experiences that you heard, the great diversity, and yet there is, it could easily fall into a political binary. If you talk about a woman choosing to carry a child to term and give it up for adoption, you can very easily be in a political debate that there is a yes and a no and a right and a left on. Were you worried at all that this would fall into that binary and that the subtlety, you know, that's carried in the literature could be lost in the political debate?
You know, this did not cross my mind when I was working on this book. This is, you know, I realize now, of course, that readers always bring their beliefs to what they read, and that's part of the contract. But this was not a political book. I was really trying to understand a very personal situation. And I think that, you know, if anything, Addie's story demonstrates just how personal decision motherhood is. But this is a personal exploration, and that's how I approached it.
An unconventional structure in that we have a narrative, but also this series of letters. Tell us about the letters.
The letters are Addie's unsent letters to her first unborn and then born son. When I first began writing the book, I wrote it from Addie's point of view in first person. Only after I had a finished manuscript did I realize that was too limiting a perspective. I couldn't get at the whole story. I was interested in why Addie makes her choices and how those choices play out, not just in her life, but in the lives of others. These are things that Addie herself can't always see. So I needed to get some distance on her. So I needed other perspectives. And so the way that the book is written now, these vignettes and short chapters are from different points of view, including Addie's, but others as well. But I did want to keep Addie's voice in the book because I wanted the story to have that intimacy, that immediacy, that almost confessional quality. I think in some ways Addie is almost in these letters, it's almost a form of seeking forgiveness from her son. So that's why the letters. I needed to keep her voice in the story.
Will you read one of them for us now?
Sure. We're going to advance to, this is a letter Addie writes to her son, whom she calls Bird. This is a letter written after he's born. And she's looking back on her decision. Dear Bird, even now I don't know why I thought to call your father after so many years. It's a question I've often asked myself. Here are some possibilities. 1, I was feeling stupid and small and wanted someone to make me feel special like your father once did. You and me, we're not like everybody else. Maybe he said that to everyone, I don't know. But when he said it to me, it seemed true. 2, I wasn't thinking of the times he had not made me feel special. 3, I'd heard from a friend that he was working as a musician in a famous place I'd never been. He had followed his dream, chased it clear across the country. He'd been brave in a way I hadn't, and I wanted to congratulate him. 4, I had lived too long among academics. 5, astrologically, I was due for an adventure, North Node in Sagittarius. 6, retrocausality. This is how my philosophy professor would have explained it. At a point farther down the space-time continuum was a child waiting to be brought into the world. I called your father because you wanted to be born.
Kim Church, reading from her debut novel. It's called Bird. And those letters, I understand, were at one point the novel, right? And then they became letters as you changed the structure when you tried to get other voices into the book.
Some of the letters were part of the novel. Mm-hmm. The first-person account by Addie in the original manuscript was really addressed to the reader, not to Addie's child. What I found with the the finished book has a lot more letters than the first manuscript did. And what I found was that we get an intimacy. The reader becomes more of a voyeur in this book. And I think readers like that. I like that as a reader.
You know what I do? I tend to trust the letter more than the other kinds of narrative, right? Because I think, well, if you're writing a letter, especially if you don't mean to send it, it might be more honest than...
Yeah, and I think that's really right here. I think we're seeing the most honest version of Addie in these letters and probably a much more honest version than we would have gotten in a first-person narrative addressed to readers.
So you're a wonderful writer. We haven't talked about the fact that you're also a lawyer.
Yes, I am.
So how do you balance those two? Do you try to do them the same? Did it affect your legal career when you decided to take writing more seriously?
Sure, yeah. I was practicing law full-time. I was a partner in a wonderful firm here in Raleigh. I was I was practicing trial law. And as any trial lawyer listening will tell you, that's a more than full-time job. When I decided to get serious about writing, I needed to make some adjustments to my life, and I decided to step away from the courtroom and actually resigned my partnership. So what I do now and what I've done in the years since is I work part-time as on a contract basis with other trial lawyers, helping them work up their cases. So I still get to work on interesting cases with great lawyers. I'm just not on the front lines anymore, and I have a little control over my schedule.
Well, lawyer and a novel then have a lot in common. Number one, words as a medium, and you use words in a different way, although I would think as a trial lawyer, crafting the narrative is precisely what you did, right?
Yes, exactly. I think trial lawyers are storytellers. And, obviously the difference between being a trial lawyer and a fiction writer is that as a fiction writer, you're making up your facts. As a trial lawyer, you're working with the facts that you have learned. But you do, there's a lot involved in figuring out the order of presentation, the witnesses through whom you're going to present your case, which facts to emphasize, which facts are not as relevant, what kinds of exhibits are useful, a chronology is incredibly important in presenting a case for trial, and in even if a book is not written in chronological order, it's key that the author understand the chronology. So, yeah, there's a lot of overlap.
Well, I would guess too that as a novelist, you can kind of get at the truth through fiction, and as a lawyer, you can sort of use a lot of facts to add up to something that may be a little less than true when it's all told, right? I mean, a picture that isn't as accurate as perhaps the DA would like to have heard.
That's an interesting observation. I think that what I learned as a trial lawyer is that it's very important to understand as much as you can about a case, to figure out what the important parts are, and to simplify. And I think the simpler you can make the story, the more plausible you can make the story, the more compelling you can make the story, the more a jury is likely to believe your story. I mean, you can interpret facts any numbers of ways, but I think it's sort of a question of looking. For me, it was always a question of where is the truth in these facts and how do you get at that?
Kim Church, what a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you for being on the program.
Thank you so much. This has been great.
Kim Church is a Raleigh-based author. Her debut novel is Bird. She is reading next month at Booktopia in Asheville. Thanks for listening to our program. Our website is stateofthings.org, where I think my mite might still be crawling across the screen. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Megan Modafferi, Anita Rao, and Will Michaels. Intern Charlie Shelton, Robin Copley, our technical director, Al Budarsky helping out today, Brent Wolf, the news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.